There's a famous passage in the canon where the young monk Ratibala is being visited by a king. And the king asks him, why did you ordain? After all, you had a lot of wealth, you had no loss in your family, no health problems. You had everything that a young man looking forward to the pleasures of sensuality could hope for. So why did you ordain? And Ratibala said that he had reflected on four Dhamma summaries from the Buddha. And it's interesting that those four summaries are mentioned nowhere else in the canon. But these were the lessons he said he learned from the Buddha. One was, the world is swept away, it does not endure. Two, the world offers no shelter, there's no one in charge. Three, the world has nothing of its own. One has to pass on, leaving everything behind. And then four, the world is insufficient, insatiable, a slave to craving. Then he explains them to the king. The first three are explained by issues of aging, illness, and death. The world is swept away. The king says, what's the meaning of that? Ratibala asks him, when you were young, were you strong? He says, oh, yes, I was strong in arm, strong in leg. In fact, sometimes I think I had the strength of two men. How about now, that you're 80? Is all the strength is all gone? In fact, sometimes I think of putting my foot in one place and it goes someplace else. So the first summary has to do with aging. It also has to do with impermanence. The world is swept away. Things keep changing, changing, changing all the time. And for the body, it develops for a while, and then it starts to age and just fall apart. The second summary, the world has no shelter, there's no one in charge. He illustrates that with the truth of illness. And it's truth about suffering as well. He illustrates it by talking about asking the king. He asks the king, do you have any recurring illness? And the king says, yes, I have a wind illness. And back in those days, they had the idea that the wind element in your body, if it got disturbed, would cause shooting pains in the body, cramps in the body. And sometimes I'm in so much pain that people gather around me think I'm going to die. And so Ratibala asks him, well, can you ask the people who've gathered around you to share out the pain so you feel less pain? The king says, no, of course not. I'm not in charge of the pain. I have to put up with whatever pain there is. There's no one in charge. So that puts together the teaching on illness and dukkha, stress and suffering. The third one, the world has nothing of its own, one has to pass on, leaving everything behind. The king says, what do you mean? I have stores of gold and silver. What do you mean the world has nothing of its own? Ratibala says, well, can you take those stores of gold and silver with you when you die, or do you have to leave them? Well, I have to leave them, of course. So that third summary has to do with not self and death. So you see those first three summaries as a parallel between what are called the three characteristics or the three perceptions: impermanence or inconstancy, stress, and not self. And also with those three deva messengers, Dhammaduta, Devaduta, aging, illness, and death. Death is the big not self teaching. So many things we hold on to in life, but we find that as death comes, we have to let them go. This is one of the reasons why meditation involves so much practice in letting go, letting go, letting go, because most of us tend to hold on, hold on, hold on. And yet the things that we hold on to are going to be ripped from our grasp as we die. And so it's best to learn how to let go, because otherwise we're going to be stuck with that fourth Dhamma summary, being insatiable, finding things insufficient, we're a slave to craving. Craving is what makes us pass on to another life where we try to latch on again. The Buddha compared it to a flame going, leaping from one house to another house. In order to leap, it had to depend on this. It said the wind element in the air, which nowadays we would think of the oxygen, as being its support as it goes from one house to the next. In this case, it's craving is the support that goes from one lifetime to the next lifetime. The Buddha doesn't talk about what it is that goes, but he goes into a lot of detail about what the process is like so we can learn not to fall for it again and again and again. It's craving for things that really are not ours. This is why we have to see the world as empty, because otherwise we fall into what they say is the king of death, which is that desire to keep on getting reborn again. Think about that. The desire to be reborn is the king of death, lording it over our hearts. So we've got to learn how to let go. And the letting go has to be very thorough. There's a passage where Anuttabindika is dying, and Sariputta comes to see him and starts telling him how to let go. First you let go of the objects of your senses, then you let go of the senses themselves, then you let go of your consciousness of the senses. Even your consciousness of what's going on in the mind, you're going to have to let go of that. And Anuttabindika starts crying. He's never heard this teaching before. In all those years he spent with the Buddha never mentioned it. There's a lot of controversy in the tradition as to why this was so. But the important thing is that that's the teaching at the moment of death. You've got to learn how to let go even of your consciousness of things. What is there left to hold on to? Well, you find that out in the practice. This is why so many of the Ajahns in Thailand refer to meditation as practice in dying. Even though we talk a lot about letting go in the practice, we do have to develop things in the practice first. This is why the Buddha has four noble truths. There's just one truth. Okay, whatever there is, let go, let go. You'd only need one noble truth. But there's some things you have to comprehend, some things you have to let go, some things you have to realize, and some things you have to develop before you can finally let go of all of them. In terms of the developing, you work on the precepts. And in one sense, that is a letting go. You let go of your desire to do and say unskillful things. But it's also developing. You have to have a strong conviction that the sacrifices you might have to make in observing the precepts are really worth making, that there's something more valuable to be gained by letting go of those skillful activities. So you've got to develop that conviction, keep it strong. And this concentration, which again involves both a letting go and a developing. The developing is finding a good solid center inside and maintaining it, looking after it. Working with the breath to make the breath comfortable so it's easier to stay here. Working with your perception of the breath. You can calm things down and make it more and more quiet inside, both in terms of what's called the physical fabrication of the breathing and the mental fabrication of the feelings and perceptions. Sometimes there's perceptions of light, sometimes there's perceptions of beings coming to talk to you, all the nimittas we hear about, all the visions we hear about. You've got to let those calm down because those are disturbances. Back when I was studying with Ajahn Phuen, sometimes his lay students would sit with him, and some of them would start having visions. And he had this uncanny ability, as many of them said, that within a second or two after the vision had appeared, he'd say, "What's going on in your meditation over there?" They say, "Well, there's a vision." Then he'd tell them what to do with the vision. Of course, a lot of the people listening in were wondering, "When am I going to have my vision?" But he's explained it. It wasn't because the vision was something special. It was an obstacle you had to get past. That's one kind of vision you have to let go of. One kind of perception you have to let go of. to calm things down inside. But there are also perceptions about how the breathing process actually works in the body, and especially if you find breathing laborious. It takes a lot of effort to breathe in. A lot of that has to do with the perception of what you're doing as you breathe. Think of all the pores in your skin opening up, and the breath can come in and out the pores. And there are channels of breath in the body that can be connected. Think of every little cell in the body being connected to every other little cell. And the breath energy is just waiting outside the body to come in. You don't have to pull it in. You just open up and it will come in. If you hold that perception in mind, it changes the way you breathe. The breathing gets a lot more calm. You're calming down what's called mental fabrication. And there's a calming down of the feeling side of mental fabrication. Sometimes there are strong feelings of rapture, thrill, grows up and down the spine. You get goosebumps. Strong feeling of fullness, feeling of fullness as if you're going to drown. And sometimes it's very pleasant, other times it gets a little unpleasant. You feel you're losing control. Or you can start to pulsate. Certainly not calming the mind down. Well, remind yourself there are many levels of breath energy in the body. There's the gross level, which you're focused on, but there are more subtle levels, and you can actually tune into them. It's like tuning from one radio station that's playing rock to something that's playing something very quiet. So even though the waves of the rock station are still here in the air, you're not focusing on them. You're focusing on the radio waves that are coming from the station that's playing Arvo Pärt. Very quiet, calm, calm music. It's the same with the breath, same with the feelings that you that come from the breath. Try to tune into the more subtle feelings of stillness, ease. Neither pleasure nor pain. You tune into that sense of equanimity. That way you calm down the mental fabrication. So it's by holding on to these different perceptions, cultivating these different perceptions, developing them, that you're able to let go of grosser things. So the path is one of combined developing and letting go. Even though eventually we're trying to let go of all states of becoming, we do have to develop this state of becoming, right concentration in the mind. So we get practice in letting go of grosser pleasures, grosser attachments. The big ones, of course, you let go of when you develop concentration. You've got to let go of the hindrances. Sensual passion, sensual desire, that's a big one. As the Buddha said, one of the reasons we're afraid of death is that we're afraid we're going to have to let go of our sensual pleasures. And we will have to let go of our sensual pleasures. The problem is that if we haven't had any practice in letting go of them, our craving will go straight to where we can find more sensual pleasures after death. And who knows where that may be. John Munn comments that there was one part in his many lifetimes and he just got fixated on all the pleasures of being a dog. Lifetimes he was a dog. And he was stuck on that level of sensuality. There's that story I've told about it. John Fung being visited by some people who had been studying the Abhidhamma. They'd heard he was a teacher and they didn't know what he taught, but they heard he was a good teacher and he was there in Bangkok, so they went to see him. So they asked what he taught. He said, well, sit down, close your eyes, focus on your breath. They said, oh, no, we can't do that. Focus on the breath, we'll get stuck on John and we'll be reborn as Brahmas. And John Fung said, what's wrong with being reborn as a Brahma? Non-returners are born as Brahmas. Anyway, being reborn as a Brahma is better than being reborn as a dog. The point he was getting to was non-returners have gone beyond sensual attachment, sensual passion. Dogs are still there, attached to their sensuality. And even though these people had learned the Abhidhamma and done all sorts of vipassana, they still were coming back to those sensual passions. It's something you've got to learn how to let go. And practicing right concentration gives you another place to go. As the Buddha once said, if you haven't found another source of pleasure that's better than that, you're just going to keep going back to it, back to it, back to it. So you've got to learn, on the one hand, to see the drawbacks of that sensual pleasure, to see why you go there, to see that the allure that it has is really false. It pulls you into doing things and getting obsessed with things that really have no value at all. They dull the mind. This is why the Buddha said that this kind of pleasure is blameworthy. Cause harm to yourself, harm to other people. And the harm to yourself, in addition to the bad karma that often comes with getting involved in that kind of stuff, is the mind gets dulled, dulled, dulled. So you've got to learn how to see that, see how the objects of your sensual passion have a lot of drawbacks themselves. Because when you're attracted to something, it's usually to certain details. You focus on some things and you like to ignore all kinds of other stuff. You focus on the skin. You forget that just a millimeter under the skin is some pretty disgusting stuff in the body. And then you go deeper and deeper in, it gets even worse. Right there in that body. And then you turn around and focus on what the sensual passion does to your mind. Everything gets very dulled and narrowed down. But if you don't know anything better than the pleasure you get from that, that's the pleasure you keep going back to. There's a story they tell of a dog that was changed into a prince. The princess fell in love with him and prevailed on her parents, even though they didn't know her. They knew it looked like a prince, acted like a prince, but they didn't know what kingdom he came from. But she was really in love with him, so she convinced the parents that he was a good prince, worthy of being her husband. Yet this prince, even though he looked like a prince on the outside, he still had the passions of a dog. So one day she found him in the bathroom eating shit out of the toilet, which dogs do in Thailand. So of course he was put out of the palace, turned back into a dog. That's kind of what our mind is like. We go for concentration for a while, and then we turn around and go look for the shit in the toilet. So you've got to see the drawbacks of those passions. They do have their allure, but you've got to balance out their allure with the drawbacks. And then try to find this pleasure, develop this source of pleasure, this alternative source of pleasure, so you have some place to stand and you can let go of that passion. As the Buddha said, when you hit non-returning, you've both mastered concentration and you've been able to get beyond sensual passion. That guarantees that you're not going to go for the dog realm or any of the sensual passion realms. But still, there's more to let go of. Because even though the Brahmas are these very refined states, those refined states don't last as long as they think they do. There are many cases in the suttas of Brahmas are totally deluded on this point. They think that they have gone beyond anything that the Buddha knows. And so the Buddha has to go up and put down their pride to show them, yeah, there's still more to let go. There's something the Buddha himself has gone beyond them, what they have. This is illustrated in one of the suttas. The Buddha disappears from this one Brahma, Bhaka Brahma. He says, okay, now try to disappear from me. And Bhaka Brahma can't disappear. The Buddha sees wherever he is. The Buddha, however, has found a level of consciousness that's not known through the senses. It's not experienced through sight, sound, smells, taste, tactile sensations, through the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind. Beyond the sensory realm, beyond the sensory world entirely. It's only when you've hit that you're really safe. Which means you have to learn how to let go of all the senses. So you try to let go first of sensuality, and then you let go of the senses entirely. the feelings that are based on the senses, the contact based on the senses, the feelings based on that contact, and then the consciousness of all these things. It's a very radical letting go. But before you can do that, you've got to develop mindfulness, concentration, alertness, all the qualities in the path. Then when the path is done, then that gets let go too. Like having a set of tools that you use to work on the mind. And then when the mind has been fully shaped, fully developed, let go of the tools. So this is how we prepare for death. So we learn how to do it well. So John Lee said, most people die without any rhyme or reason, just whatever the mind happens to latch on to in those last moments. And it's capable of latching on to all kinds of stuff, if you haven't trained it. If you have trained it, you have more control over it. It's the same as when you're meditating. You see the mind flickering off to another thought, which develops into a little thought world, a little becoming. And you learn how to catch it more and more quickly. And you realize that it's not just the mindfulness and alertness, but it's also your sense of values, the desire to go there, seeing that as something worthwhile. You've got to learn how to train it so it doesn't get pulled in, doesn't get hoodwinked by these flashy lights and all the allure of these different worlds. As you've developed that skill with your meditation, you're closer and closer to having the skill that's capable of facing death and handling it well. So that you have your protection. I mean, death is going to happen anyway, but you can protect your mind from dying in an unskillful way, and you do that by learning to live in a skillful way. In all your actions, in all your words, and in the way you handle your mind. So fortunately, learning how to die skillfully is no different from learning how to live skillfully. You cover both issues while you're here, as you're practicing. So try to be heedful. Heedful doesn't mean simply being diligent and busy with a practice, but also means having a strong sense that we don't have much time. We have to focus our energies on the areas that really will help us in the event that, let's say, a little blood clot starts wandering through your bloodstream, wandering here, wandering there, finally, whoop, gets lodged in your heart, and that's it. That earthquake that they keep threatening. These things can happen at any time. Someone was forecasting that there's going to be a huge earthquake off the coast of Oregon this year. They'd had a vision. Well, you never know about visions, but hey, it could happen at any time. So you've got to be prepared. So heedfulness means seeing that there are dangers here in the mind. And it really behooves you to work on them as quickly as you can. Maintain your focus and not let it get distracted off into other ways of wasting the time that you've got. So you've got this breath, this breath, this breath. As the Buddha said, if you're on top of each breath realizing, I'm fortunate, I've got this one more breath, I can practice the Buddha's teachings. That's when you count as heedful. Don't let your breaths be wasted.